Our next case this morning is the number 053953, the United States of Inspection.
Thank you, Your Honor. I plead the court, Mr. Morrison. Robert Baskin was convicted of possessing a firearm after having previously been convicted of a felony. The firearm which Mr. Baskin was convicted of possessing was found in his home on November 10, 2004, pursuant to a search warrant, which was issued in a Marion County court. Mr. Baskin pled guilty pursuant to a plea agreement, which allowed him to plead a conditional plea of guilty, reserving his right to appeal the district court's denial of his motion to suppress the search of his home, which produced the firearm. And that, of course, is why we're here today, to review the court's decision on the motion to suppress. The search warrant was based on an affidavit filed by Officer Perklick, based entirely on what he reported to the court was told to him by a witness at the scene, Tammy Stock Wilson. Those two people both testified at the suppression hearing. The suppression hearing was, as the judge recognized, a Franks hearing, based on a pre-hearing tender by Mr. Baskin, by myself on behalf of Mr. Baskin, that Officer Perklick had included false statements, either intentionally or recklessly made in the affidavit for a search warrant, and therefore the warrant should be declared in violation of the Fourth Amendment and the search set aside. The affidavit, which is before the court, is very brief. There are really three statements in the affidavit which give rise to, or in the mind of the judge who issued the warrant, gave rise to the conclusion that there was probable cause to search the house. As I acknowledge, the district court judge found that Ms. Stock Wilson was not a particularly credible witness, but I suggest to the court today that when the testimony of Officer Perklick at the suppression hearing is considered, that testimony alone is enough to establish that some of the statements that he made in the affidavit in support of the search warrant were false. Now, let's speak to the three statements which I suggest to you are the only statements that have anything to do with the proposition that a firearm would be found in Mr. Baskin's house, which, of course, was what the probable cause needed to establish. In the affidavit, Officer Perklick said before he pushed her being Ms. Stock Wilson, she could see a pistol in his hand. She testified that she never told the officer that, and he testified that wasn't exactly what she told him. Shortly after the incident, Officer Perklick filed his standard police report in which he said, I talked to Ms. Stock Wilson. She told me that when Mr. Baskin came out of the front door of the house, his hand was behind his right thigh, and she thought he had a gun in the hand. That's not what he put in the affidavit. He put in the affidavit that, quote, she could see a pistol in his hand. At the suppression hearing, Officer Perklick confirmed that that's what Ms. Stock Wilson had told him. So those two witnesses are consistent on that fact, and they're consistent on the proposition that the statement in the affidavit is false. Second fact. This is quoting from Officer Perklick's affidavit. She, being Ms. Stock Wilson, said, when she was in the bushes, Baskin fired two shots from the porch. Ms. Stock Wilson testified that she did not see Mr. Baskin fire two shots. Officer Perklick testified at the suppression hearing that she did not tell him that she saw Mr. Baskin fire the shots, that she assumed that he fired the shot. But again, that's not what Officer Perklick said in the affidavit. So I think the two witnesses at the suppression hearing were consistent on that fact, and the fact is that this was a false statement in the affidavit.
Did she tell him that she heard two shots?
She did tell the officer that she heard two shots.
At that time she called 911, right?
Yes, that's correct. She heard two shots and she assumed that they had been fired by Mr. Baskin. But the point, Your Honor, is that that's what should have been put in the affidavit. Officer Perklick drew the inference and put in the affidavit something as a fact, which was not a fact. If the affidavit had said she told me that she assumed that Mr. Baskin fired the shot, then the judge could have done what the judge is supposed to do, and that is draw the inference from the facts as to whether he in fact had fired the gun.
Mr. Marsh, taking into account all of these discrepancies, and indeed giving you the benefit of the doubt on these discrepancies, doesn't the affidavit still establish probable cause?
Your Honor, I suggest the answer is no. It does not establish probable cause to believe that the firearms was in the home. It may establish probable cause. It does establish probable cause that there was a gun, that the gun had been on the porch. But the key fact, which needs to be found by the judge in order to issue the warrant, is that the item being sought will be found in the place in which the officer desires to search. And that's, in this case, a home. The area which the court well knows is the area most protected by the Fourth Amendment. So probable cause to believe that Mr. Baskin had a gun, probable cause to believe that he fired the gun, does not establish probable cause to search the home. Yet that was the warrant that was being sought by the officer, and that was the warrant that was issued. The third fact, then, is that she said, and this is quoting from Officer Perklick's affidavit, Ms. Stock Wilson said that he went inside the house with a pistol in his hand and then came back outside without the pistol. Ms. Stock Wilson testified that she never said that. She testified that she never saw a pistol in his hand. And at the suppression hearing, Officer Perklick did not contradict her testimony at the suppression hearing. He didn't say anything about whether, at the suppression hearing, he didn't say anything about whether Ms. Stock Wilson had told him that Mr. Baskin went into the house with a pistol in his hand. So I respectfully suggest, Your Honor, that those statements have been established at the suppression hearing to be false, that they were recklessly made. I don't think the evidence establishes that they were intentionally made. They were recklessly made without proper consideration of the truth or falsity of the statements. When those statements are excised from the affidavit, what's left does not leave probable cause to believe that a firearm would be found in the home, and therefore the search warrant violated the Fourth Amendment, the search violated the Fourth Amendment, and the decision of the district court judge denying the motion to suppress should be reversed.
What was left when you take out those portions to which you alluded to was that he was on the porch, shots were fired, shell casings were found?
Yes.
And he wasn't on the porch when the police showed up?
That's correct. Thank you.
Mr. Marsh,
please the court. My name is Timothy Morrison. I represent the government in this case. Although there are different discrepancies amongst these witnesses, the district court still determined the credibility issue, that being that the court found more credibility with Officer Perklick's statement than she did with the statement of Stock Wilson. But as the court has already noted, if you even denude all these statements out of the affidavit, assuming arguendo that they may be false, what you are left with is a domestic altercation. You are left with shots which another police officer hears from some distance and responds, so we fix the time of the shots. In other words, the officer is responding as these shots are fired. When they appear, there is Stock Wilson talking to the officer, another officer is at the doorway talking to Mr. Baskin, the defendant, and shell casings are found on the steps outside of Mr. Baskin's residence. I submit to you that in itself, looking at that, is probable cause. And even if those were arguendo believed to be false, and thus stricken from the affidavit, that even considering what is still left, there would be sufficient evidence there to support the warrant which was issued. Finally, what we're talking about here is not an officer who has been inventing something as far as the ultimate fact, because there's really no question in this case of the ultimate fact that shots were fired by Mr. Baskin. That's what Stock Wilson says. That's what the evidence demonstrates from the shell casings. There is no other culprit out here, no third party, no other choice that is to be made or expected to be made from what the evidence is. And based on that, even if you would assume that some of these statements would be wrong or false, which the district court did not find, even if you were to do that, there still is substantial evidence there to establish probable cause and sustain this. And that's what the government would ask you to do, is to affirm the district court's decision not to suppress this evidence and thus his conviction.
Thank you, Mr. Marshall. How much time is Mr. Marshall? Mr. Marshall, you have two minutes.
Thank you, Judge. I'll only take part of it to make two points. First, with respect to the credibility of the witnesses, I think I tried to explain that Mr. Baskin's position is that the witnesses were consistent on the critical facts. Judge Barker did, of course, find that Ms. Stock-Wilson was not a credible witness, but she also made a finding that there were discrepancies in Officer Perklick's testimony. This is in footnote 9 of her opinion, which is in our appendix at page 17, where she acknowledges that, quote, while these discrepancies may cast some doubt on Officer Perklick's testimony, they do nothing short of the credibility of Ms. Stock-Wilson. So the district court has concerns about the credibility of both of the witnesses. Finally, the issue is not a general question of whether there was probable cause. Was there probable cause? Sure, there was probable cause of many things, no doubt. The only question is whether there was probable cause to believe that the firearm would be found in the home. Was there probable cause to arrest Mr. Baskin for criminal recklessness? Yes. Was there probable cause to believe the shots had been fired? Yes. Was there probable cause to believe that the gun was going to be found in this home? No. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Marsh. Mr. Morrison as well. The case will be taken under advisement. United States against John Joyner.
Thank you, Your Honor, and please, Court. I suppose to anyone who practices in the area of doing drug cases, this case is entirely predictable that it's here in the post-Booker world. What happened in this case is that the district court categorically rejected the 100-to-1 ratio that Congress has mandated of crack to powder, and instead adopted a sentencing its own preferred ratio of 21 and imposed sentence according to its own ratio. What the practical effect of that was in this case was instead of a sentence under the advisory sentencing guidelines of 135 to 168 months, the court crafted the 20-to-1 ratio and sentenced the defendant at a 70 to 87 month ratio, ultimately imposing the sentence of 87 months. I think it's important to look at the background of this particular case because these are the instances that the court alluded to in sentencing this defendant. In this case, Mr. Joyner made three sales of crack cocaine to an undercover police officer on three different occasions. On one of the occasions, Mr. Joyner informed the undercover police officer that if Mr. Joyner found out that he was the police, he would kill him and go to jail for murder and dope. While Mr. Joyner was doing these sales of crack cocaine to this undercover police officer, he was also on probation for possession of cocaine. And then while Mr. Joyner was in the process of being arrested as a result of a traffic stop, he resisted arrest, pushed one of the police officers out of the way, fled, and engaged in conduct which the district court found to constitute reckless endangerment during flight. And then finally, Mr. Joyner, in a post-arrest statement, admitted that he had been dealing crack cocaine and cocaine since 2001, his arrest was in 2004. He indicated that during that time he had amassed between 4 and 5 kilograms of cocaine, which he himself cooked into crack cocaine, and he subsequently distributed that cocaine. Since this case has, since Mr. Joyner has sentenced, two circuits have had the occasion to address this case. The First Circuit in the case of the United States against Foe, and the Fourth Circuit in the case of the United States against Europe. In both of those cases, the First Circuit and the Fourth Circuit held that the district court could not, or was not permitted to change the congressionally mandated ratio of 100-1 that's found in the mandatory minimums and varied in the guidelines, and sentence the defendant under a ratio other than that. For to do that would be making a policy decision, and that is what the district court did in this case.
In the statutory scheme, could you explain to me again, about a mandatory minimum, is that a separate statute as apart from, of course, the sentencing guidelines?
Yes, sir.
So we have a 5-year mandatory minimum.
Yes. Anyone who possesses with the intent to distribute or distribute over 5 grams but less than 50 grams of crack cocaine is subject to a mandatory minimum of not less than 5 years and a sentence of not more than 40 years.
But the ratio of 100-1 is found in the sentencing guidelines?
Yes, sir, Your Honor.
And not statutory?
Not statutory, but certainly reflecting the will of Congress. Congress has mandated that crack cocaine and powder cocaine are different. Indeed, this court on a number of occasions has upheld the differential, the 100-1 differential on many, many grounds.
I understand it, but I'm just trying to Congress did not pass a law saying 100-1, then put it in a mandatory minimum statute, for example. Rather said, Sentencing Commission, we want you to put 101 in your guidelines, right?
Well, what happened, Your Honor, as the guidelines, as they were enacted in 1987, the Sentencing Commission...
Well, remember when they were...
...adopted the 100-1 ratio in the drug quantity table to mirror Congress's intent to reflect the differential between crack and powder. But it is not a statute. That was delegated to the Sentencing Commission.
So how does that, we're dealing with congressional intent rather than a congressional enactment.
I believe that's true, Your Honor. What the district court has done something, has gone against the will of Congress. The will of Congress is that crack cocaine and powder cocaine be treated differently, and that they be treated at a ratio of 100-1. Indeed, as the court is no doubt aware, the Sentencing Commission has on numerous occasions sent recommendations to Congress to either do away with the ratio or change the ratio.
What do we do now that the sentencing guidelines are advisory only?
As far as, Your Honor?
Any of the content of the 101.
I think it's what the First Circuit in Foe and the Fourth Circuit in Europe found was that sentencing and setting the penalties for criminal offenses is within the purview of Congress. I'm not suggesting that...
But they normally do that by statute.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
You normally would do that. Congress would normally do that by statute.
And it may very well be that Congress does ultimately address this problem by enacting a statute. My understanding is that they are monitoring what's going on as far as sentences.
We all know that. We all know that we're under a lot of scrutiny on this, but we have to decide this case according to the law. Now, it's the position of the government that a district judge can never sentence using a ratio other than the 100-1 in any case?
As it relates of crack to powder?
Yep.
I believe that until Congress acts and changes that ratio, which they're certainly free to do, that is what the guidelines are.
Can the United States District Judge say, I understand the ratio is 100-1, and go ahead and calculate the guideline sentence using the guidelines as they exist, the 100-1 ratio, and then say, I do not think that in this particular case, for the following reasons, that ratio is an appropriate benchmark for sentencing, and therefore I'm going to sentence at a far lower sentence than the 100 to 1. Did he do that?
I think it's certainly clear to me that in the post-Booker rule, Your Honor, a district court need not sentence a defendant under the guidelines, and can certainly vary under the guidelines for individual reasons that pertain to an individual defendant and an individual case. But that's not what we have in this case. In this case, the only reason that the record reflects that the district court varied from the guidelines, what amounts to a sixth-level variance from the guidelines, is that the district court was under the impression that the 100-to-1 ratio should not be the policy. The district court made a policy call.
So the district court heard when it substituted its judgment for the judgment of the commission in Congress as to what the advisory level ought to be.
Yes, sir, Your Honor.
That would be error.
Yes, sir. Made a mistake of law.
If the district court had said, I acknowledge that, I calculated, as we have said he has to, we have said he has to do the calculation as part of the methodology. But once that's done, does he have the right to say, but I'm not going to hand down this sentence, the advisory sentence that he just calculated. I'm going to give a lower sentence.
If the district court's desire to vary from the guidelines is based solely on its disagreement with Congress's policy judgment that crack cocaine be treated at a ratio of 100 to 1 to calories,
as opposed to the facts and circumstances of the individual case.
Yes, sir.
Which you would have to set forth on the record so that we could review it and determine whether it was reasonable.
Yes, sir.
The concurrence in Europe goes through the scenario that Judge Griffin described. And it seems to me that it was based, in Europe, with the same problem, where the judge just disagreed with that ratio. But the concurrence went through an analysis of 3553A, if you applied a lot of those different principles and individuating the situation, then it could, but you would have to recite them all in some detail so that when we review it, we know that the departure, that it was reasonable not to follow the guidelines, and in that particular case would be lower, a lot of times it's higher. Now, are you familiar with the concurrence in Europe?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that a scenario that the government could agree with?
As long as there were individual factors that were spelled out, individual to the case and the defendant, and that the variance was not just on the district court's disagreement with the policy judgment that Congress made, I believe that this court could review a sentence for reasonableness.
Where you'd have to see those things set out. For instance, if somebody is sick, has cancer, or has some other reason, or was peripherally involved, lots of things that might mitigate. Of course, a lot of things under 3553A are not mitigating. They move the thing up, so they're aggravating, I guess. But at least that scenario is available. It's not a lockstep just because you didn't follow the guidelines. If someone says, I disagree with the policy, therefore I'm going to say lower, as opposed to, yes, I understand the policy, but here are the reasons why this it would be reasonable to go below or above.
Yes, Your Honor, as long as it wasn't a disagreement that the district court had with the policy, and that was the reason for the area so long.
It goes beyond, because there are other reasons.
And
I'll recite all of those so that show that why it's reasonable not to follow that guidance.
Yes, and as this court said, the Dean case said the 3553A reasons don't need to all be spelled out, but there are scenarios under that construction. I believe there could be a variance with the guidance.
Didn't Judge McKinney in this case try to do that and they say it was individual?
Your Honor, I went through the sentencing transcript many, many times, and in my reading of the sentencing transcript, all of the factors that he recited, that this defendant was on probation, that he'd been dealing for a long time, all are what could be termed as aggravating factors. He did say that this defendant was not an importer or an organizer, a street level dealer, but I would respectfully suggest that in probably 13 years of prosecuting nothing but drug cases, most all of the cases are done on the street. I would also suggest that crack cocaine is not imported. It's produced here domestically. And it's very difficult to have an organizer in a one person, one defendant case.
He cooked it too, right?
He did cook it, absolutely, Your Honor. He admitted that he did. And he admitted that he cooked it, got multiple kilograms of it, and then put it out on the street.
Mr. Lefman, I corrected to the case, declined to consider the relevant conduct.
He did decline to consider the relevant. He considered it, Your Honor, but he rejected it. And rather than holding this defendant responsible for between 4 and 5 kilograms of crack cocaine, he held the defendant responsible for 80 kilograms of crack cocaine, and then reduced it even further by applying the 20-to-1 ratio that the court thought appropriate.
Thank you, Mr. Clifton.
Thank you.
We'll hear now from Mr. McKinley.
May it please the court, good morning. My name is James McKinley. I'm with the Federal Defender's Office, and in 7 years with the Federal Defender's Office, I've never filed a brief with a red cover, and I've never had the opportunity to stand before this court and say the district court got it right. But it did do its duty. I understand the government's argument that the error claimed here is as to Judge McKinney's methodology in formulating the sentence. And they describe that methodology as reflecting a categorical policy-based rejection of congressional intent, and therefore the sentence was unreasonable as a matter of law. Well, it wasn't. What Judge McKinney did here is precisely what he was required to do under the relevant statutes and under the Supreme Court's holding in Booker. He started with 21 U.S.C. 841, which mandates a 5-year minimum sentence. Statutory range is 5 to 40. There's no question the sentence of 87 months here was within that range. He then turned to 3553, which requires the court to formulate and impose a sentence that's sufficient but not greater than necessary to comply with the purposes of sentencing. After considering nature and circumstances of the offense, history and characteristics of the individual, the need to avoid unwarranted disparity, and of course, the sentencing guidelines, which is where he went next. He calculated the sentencing guidelines, the advisory range here, in a manner that's not in dispute between the parties. Level 32, criminal history category 3, generating a range of 135 to 168 months. He then went to the next level and emphasized on the record the importance of the history and characteristics of the individual and the importance of evaluating the nature and circumstances of the offense. He went on to assess what I would call the real offense conduct here, which involves an analysis that entails much more than just looking at the quantity of drugs and the nature of the drugs, that being crack cocaine in this case. An analysis that requires the court to assess such things as well. Is this guy a high-level distributor that is out there motivated simply by profit? Or is he a low-level street dealer who's out there feeding his own habit, which is what this case was? The court emphasized the significance that this particular defendant was a street-level dealer. There was no violence in this case. The court made no finding that there was credible threats of violence. There were no guns involved in the case. And the court then went on and had to assess whether those case-specific facts made this range sufficient or more than sufficient to comply with the purpose of sentencing. And Chief Judge McKinney was persuaded that the advisory guideline range was more than sufficient. Understand that the guideline range is subordinate to that parsimony principle in the first part of 3553A. The court is required to impose a sentence sufficient but not greater than necessary. That's the cap, over above in which no lawful sentence can be imposed. That is the limit.
And the court was persuaded that the sentencing guideline range in this case was more than necessary. It was only then that he turned to the 20-to-1 ratio. And he looked at the ratio, made this other calculation, came out to the level 25, criminal history 3, generated a sentencing range of 70 to 87 months. And then on the record, analyzed whether that was sufficient. Was it sufficient to afford adequate deterrence? Was it sufficient to promote the other purposes of sentencing reflected in 3553A, and concluded that a sentence at the high end, 87 months, that was sufficient. He concluded that was a just sentence in light of what this particular street dealer did, and it was a sentence consistent with the way he had seen similarly situated defendants involved in similar conduct with similar background sentenced in his court, sentenced within the Southern District of Indiana, and sentenced with in other jurisdictions around the country.